All right, good afternoon. Welcome to the Special Committee on House Military and Veterans Affairs. The time is 1:03. Present is Representative Story, myself, Representative Tuck. We're here in the Gruenberg Room. Today is Thursday, February 10th. I expect more members to be arriving. There's a lot of activity that's going on in the building right now. And also joining us is Representative Clayman. Because this is an informational hearing, a quorum is not necessary to begin, so we're going to go ahead and begin. I want to thank Lydia Klein in the back with the Juno LIO for moderating this meeting, and also Shannon McCain, who is here from House Records for documenting today's meeting. Today, as I said earlier, we are holding an informational hearing on the Oath Keepers and their role in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. I want to make this very clear. This is informational. Contrary to what bloggers are writing, it is not an inquisition, nor is it an investigation. It is strictly informational. And so this committee, because we're not taking any actions, we do not have a quorum to move forward. We have two highly regarded experts in domestic extremism scheduled to testify today. First up will be investigative research Alex Friedfeld with the Anti-Defamation League Center on Extremism. Mr. Friedfeld has a PowerPoint presentation. Copies were emailed to committee members, and printed copies are in the back, and we have copies around everybody's desks. After Mr. Friedfeld's presentation, we hear from John Lewis with the program on extremists at George Washington University. Mr. Lewis also has a PowerPoint presentation, and those copies are distributed in the same way. So, Mr. Friedfeld, if you don't mind introducing yourself and begin your presentation.
Absolutely. Good afternoon, everyone. Before I begin, I would just like to thank Chairman Tuck and members of this committee for organizing this hearing and giving me this opportunity to speak. I'm here on behalf of the Anti-Defamation League, an organization that has been committed to combating hate in all of its forms for 108 years. In furtherance of that mission, I work for the Center on Extremism, the arm of the ADL that is tasked with monitoring, exposing, and disrupting violent extremism. We track extremism across the spectrum, from the far left to the far right. And as part of that work, I've been watching the Oath Keepers over the last few years, and I'm eager to share what I've learned in that time. So if you move on to the next slide, I'd like to start with this image from the January 6th Capitol attack, because I think this photo helps to set the stakes for everything that I'm going to talk about. If you look at this photo, it's pretty easy to spot the Oath Keepers. And in general, when you look at the broader footage from that day, it's not hard to pick them out from the crowd. And there's a few things that I want to touch on. Notice their helmets and the tactical gear compared to the people around them who are wearing normal clothes. Notice the way that they have their hands on the shoulders of the person ahead of them and the level of organization as they move forward in a stack formation, which stands in sharp contrast to the chaotic crowd around them. They even stand out in their focus. The people in this photo are all looking in different directions, but the Oath Keepers are not. They're all moving in the same direction as one. All of this was by design and the culmination of years of work. And so what I'd like to do with the time allotted to me is trace the history of the ideology and the group that led to these men and women climbing the Capitol steps and breaching the building. But in order to understand the Oath Keepers, one needs to understand the movement that they are a part of, and that is the militia movement. We can go one more slide. So the militia movement is a right-wing extremist movement that emerged in the 1990s and consists of armed paramilitary groups that hold an anti-government, conspiracy-oriented ideology. At the core of that ideology is the idea that the federal government has been co-opted by a shadowy conspiracy and is now actively trying to strip Americans of their rights so that the people can be enslaved. Typically, this conspiracy is referred to as the New World Order. And according to militiamen, the New World Order already controls, you know, the rest of the world. And the United States is the last bastion of freedom. Stemming from this overarching conspiracy are a few popular secondary conspiracies, with each theory going back to this idea that the government has fallen under global governance and will at some point use the police and military forces to enforce the New World Order's plans. And these conspiracies include things like, you know, police and military going door to door to seize guns, the government suspending the Constitution and then declaring martial law, FEMA building concentration camps to imprison dissidents, or the government conspiring to pursue a depopulation agenda to weaken the people, you know, say, for example, through a manufactured pandemic. In line with this last idea, since the emergence of COVID in 2020, we've seen the militia movement engage in conspiracies that are anti-lockdown, anti-mask, and anti-vax, with the idea being that the government is using COVID responses to strip away liberties or physically weaken the people so that they can ultimately be enslaved. In the face of all of these purported terrible things that are happening or on the verge of happening, militias believe it's up to the people to ensure that they don't and to fight back if they do. And so it's for this reason that there is such a heavy emphasis on gun ownership and paramilitary training among militias. Because without guns and training, the balance of power would favor the state and the people would be at risk for enslavement. One important kind of classification note when it comes to militias, while there are white supremacists who are part of the militia movement, it is not inherently white supremacist. It's possible to find people of color who are members of these ranks, and these groups frequently say that they will accept anyone as members, right? And that's something you just won't see with white supremacist groups. Similarly, white supremacist groups engage in different kinds of conspiratorial thinking, and they have no interest in nominally, you know, preserving or saving the Constitution. They want to burn the whole system down and put white people at the top. That said, militias do frequently engage in tropes that frame minorities and people of color as threats to the country, be it immigrants coming across the southern border, or Muslims in America trying to impose Sharia law, or Black Lives Matter being a Marxist uprising. It's just that it's not their organizing principle. So go to the next slide. I think we're there. Yeah. As I said at the top, the militia movement formed in the 90s, specifically 93 to 94, in response to a few different things. First, you had the proliferation of New World Order conspiracies that were fueled by the collapse of the Soviet Union, the formation of NAFTA, and UN skepticism. Then there were new gun control legislation passed in 93 and 94, which required background checks and banned certain kinds of assault weapons. And these were viewed as the first steps towards mass gun confiscation. And then you had the 92 Ruby Ridge and the 1993 Waco standoffs, which extremists interpreted as evidence that the government would kill anyone that opposed it. And so militia proponents used these events to urge the formation of new militias to ensure that the people were never weak enough to let these things happen again. So throughout the 90s, militias rode this new energy and used things like VHS tapes, pamphlets, and a nascent internet to expand. But then their, you know, growth flagged during the Bush administration, partially because of the natural passing of time and partially because they weren't staunchly opposed to a more conservative administration. Militias didn't love Bush, but at the same time, they didn't hate him at the same way that they hated President Clinton. We go to the next slide. But then came 2008, and the movement ballooned once more. So first you had the election of President Obama, which gave the militia movement someone to hate again, right? And there were all these fears that he would impose socialism. And then you had a financial crash, which created waves of uncertainty, which is, which extremists like to take advantage of in order to recruit new members to their cause. At the same time, you had social media explode, creating opportunities for militias to network and recruit as new populations were introduced to the militia movement via the internet. And key to this spread was the rise of the 3%er concept, which was started in 2008 and is based on the myth that only 3% of colonists rose up and fought the British, but critically that they were the ones who achieved liberty for everyone. What set the 3%ers apart from other militias was that anyone could declare themselves a 3%er without formally joining an organization, right? So now instead of putting in the work to track down like-minded people, right, going to events or participating in training, all you had to do was slap a decal on your car or change your Facebook profile photo, or even just say you're a 3%er, and then you were in. So as a result of all these factors, the barriers to joining were dramatically lowered. And as a result, by 2011, there were likely over 100,000 militia followers across the country. Over the next few years, things stayed relatively the same on an ideological level until the rise of President Trump in 2015 and his election in 2016. And so if we go to the next slide, the militia movement had an unusual relationship with President Trump. Candidate Trump was the first major party candidate that the movement supported. And when he was elected, this created dissonance among militiamen, right? And that is because what do you do when you're a group that was formed to oppose the federal government, but the person you like is now running it? The way they resolve this is that, by and large, they started to focus more on enemies and issues other than the federal government. Things such as immigrants coming across the border, opposing Muslims, or the new enemy at the time, and that's Antifa. As part of the shift, beginning in 2017, militia groups increasingly started to show up at protests and counter-protests of different kinds, as you can see with the photo on the left. They claimed that they were there to provide security, to support law enforcement, or to protect everybody's rights, but usually they were just there to stare down, you know, perceived leftists. But I think the lockdown protests in 2020 are a particularly good case study of how militias handled the tension created by their support for President Trump. Given all the turmoil in 2020, one would have expected the militias to continue to target the federal government, maybe because they believed it was created COVID to depopulate the people, or maybe because they thought the government was trying to use COVID as an excuse to take away people's liberties. But rather than directing their outrage at the federal government, they shifted their focus towards state and local officials, especially if they were Democrats, though they did target Republicans as well. And so all of a sudden, it became common to hear militias framing local officials as the tyrannical enemy and referring to them using the same terms they previously reserved for the federal government. Right? And I think the image on the right kind of illustrates that mentality. That's a 3%er in Kentucky who is hanging an effigy of Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear. We go to the next slide. This shift, though, was not a permanent change. And since it became clear that President Biden was going to be the next president, militias have returned to targeting the federal government with their anger, spreading the idea that the election was stolen as part of some leftist coup, and then framing the Biden administration as an illegitimate administration intent upon war with conservatives and trying to destroy the country. These are deeply disturbing ideas that obviously have no grounding in reality, but they help to drive the militia participation in the Stop the Steal campaign, as well as their involvement in the Capitol attack. Go to the next slide. The problem with the militia mode of viewing the world and their way of viewing politics, right, is that this line of thinking and rhetoric leaves you nowhere to go. If you believe the government is tyrannical and wants to do bad things to you and your family, then what hope do you have that the government will be responsive through the normal avenues of democracy? And so as a result, the idea of working through the ballot box or engaging in traditional activism goes out the window, and the idea of using violence starts to seem more reasonable. And so unsurprisingly, we have seen a notable amount of criminality and violence emerge from the militia movement. Though members frequently insist that militias are just organizations trying to protect people's rights in their communities, the track record really tells a different story, one where some militiamen have been willing to take the fight to the government or even to their fellow citizens, right? And so what you're looking at here on this slide are just a few headlines of plots going back to 2017. And they include people trying to bomb banks, kill police officers, and target George Floyd protests, amongst a whole bunch of other things. But if we go to the next slide, I'd like to briefly highlight one of the more notable militia plots in recent years, and that is the case of the Wolverine Watchmen. These guys were arrested in October of 2020 for allegedly plotting to kidnap Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer because they believed she was using COVID to impose tyranny. According to court documents, they talked about doing a bunch of different terrible things to her, including shooting her when she opened the door, executing her live on television, or even just setting her adrift on the Great Lakes. This is all obviously deeply disturbing. But the Wolverine Watchmen, I think, are a good example of how the conspiracies and the violent rhetoric of the militia movement can poison people's minds and lead to violence. Right? Here you have a group of men who believe that the government was trying to use COVID to take away their rights. And rather than relying on their vote or other forms of activism, they allegedly decide to take matters into their own hands and use violence to free themselves, and they hope the rest of the country.
Real quick, if I may interrupt just briefly.
Please.
Just wanted to point out that Representative Tarr joined us about 1:17 p.m. Thank you, Representative Tarr. Please continue.
Great, will do. So that's an overview of the militia movement. And now I want to shift to talking about one of the largest groups within that movement, and that is the Oath Keepers. So if you go to the next slide, great. As part of the militia movement, the Oath Keepers generally believe all the same conspiracies as the rest of the militia movements, regarding the notion that the government has been co-opted and is now trying to impose tyranny. What sets them apart, though, from other groups is their explicit focus on targeting current and former law enforcement, military, and emergency personnel with their messaging recruitment, although they will accept anyone as members. Now, historically, militias have been deeply skeptical of law enforcement and the military because they believe these entities to be the arm of this government responsible for imposing and enforcing tyranny. But the Oath Keepers looked at these entities slightly differently. They agreed that if an unconstitutional were to be issued, it would be up to law enforcement and military to enforce it, but they also believe that this is a process that can be stopped. And so as such, they want to reach these individuals first to ensure, they want to reach them first to ensure that they are prepared to refuse and even resist any orders that the Oath Keepers deem to be unconstitutional. So we go to the next slide. The Oath Keepers were founded and led by the man you see on the right, Stuart Rhodes. Rhodes enlisted and was discharged from the Army after getting hurt in training back in the 90s. He's a Yale-educated lawyer who has since been disbarred, and he worked for a time for Senator Ron Paul. Since founding the group in 2009, Rhodes has been the dominating force in guiding the group's strategic decisions as well as their messaging. The way the Oath Keepers are set up, there is a national organization that sets the group's priorities and agenda, but underneath it is a constellation of official, semi-official, or informal groupings of Oath Keepers that operate on a more local level. Now, it's difficult to kind of get an assessment of just how many Oath Keepers there are across the country, but the number is likely in the thousands. There was a data leak last year that showed that as of a few years ago, the group had over 38,000 people who signed up at one point or another. But this total is almost certainly far higher than the actual number of active members, as it includes duplicates, people who died, people who never re-upped their membership, as well as people who were never active in the first place. While most people associated with the group have no military, police, or EMS experience, according to our analysis, as well as public reporting, the group has had some success in recruiting people who are part of these services. So, for example, we found 133 people who used their military email addresses to sign up, and news reports have documented numerous instances of military and police personnel who have joined the group. Go to the next slide, great. There are numerous reasons why it's deeply problematic for members of law enforcement and the military to be part of extremist groups, including, you know, security and information concerns, sowing distrust and damaging morale within the ranks, and even harming mission effectiveness. But I want to highlight two in particular. First, their membership greatly undermines civilian trust in these institutions. And actually, if I'm looking, I think we're one slide ahead. If we go back one, that one, yeah. So their membership undermines civilian trust in these institutions. Americans have the right to expect that the people who we ask to serve the public are not under the sway of extremist ideologies that could affect the way that they do their job, right? Which in the case of law enforcement and the military could put people's lives in danger. Secondly, the training that these people receive when they join the military or police makes them unique dangers in the event that they ever do actually decide to act, as we saw in the January 6th attack. They were trained in skills that were taught to be used in one setting, but then those same skills were used to advance an extremist agenda and attack the foundations of this country. And obviously, that's deeply problematic. Before I get into what the Oath Keepers have done over the years, I'd like to dig a little bit more into their guiding mission of nominally opposing unconstitutional orders. Because on the surface, this seems, you know, eminently reasonable, right? Who's for unconstitutional orders? But a closer look shows the issue with the Oath Keeper mentality. For one, the Oath Keeper assessment of what is unconstitutional is warped by conspiracy, typically not grounded in any legal basis, and usually just reflects their opposition to policies. So as kind of a general example of this, what you see on this slide are a declaration of orders that the oath keepers will not obey that's up on their website. And I want to note that this is actually a really important document for them. A quick scan, you know, through these orders shows numerous references to old school militia, New World Order conspiracies regarding things like mass gun confiscation, liberties being stripped away, detention in concentration camps, and the government just generally, you know, turning on the American people. It frames the government as an inherently nefarious entity that has the ability to pursue these courses of action at will, thereby undermine the legitimacy of the government, even though we have laws and systems in place to prevent these things, these kinds of things from ever happening. If we go to the next slide, this is where things get even more dangerous, right? At the bottom of that list of orders, the oathkeepers note that it is not exhaustive, leaving the door open for opposing other laws and orders as well. It also explicitly links their opposition with the revolutionary spirit, demonstrating their willingness to engage in warfare if need be, and once again, baselessly framing the government as something that is willing to enslave the people. We go to the next slide. Another thing that the oathkeepers like to do is make themselves, in order to make themselves seem more reasonable, is to appeal to patriotism. However, what they're actually doing is weaponizing patriotism for their own end, twisting it around so that it targets the state itself. And the most obvious way that they do this is by referring to the oath that enlisted people take when they sign up for the military, as you see on the left, which they print right before getting into that list of orders that they would disobey. Here they're openly evoking the pledge to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Right? And obviously with the Oath Keepers, there's this emphasis on the domestic side of things. If you go to the next slide, they conveniently leave out the rest of the oath, right? That I will obey the orders of the President of the United States and the orders of the officers appointed over me, as well as the references to regulations and the Uniform Military Code of Justice. This edit shows the true intention of the Oath Keepers, and that is to weaken the chain of command and turn people against the very government that they swore to support. Now, to be fair, elsewhere on their website, they do acknowledge that this clause exists and that the oath does contain an obligation to adhere to regulations and the Uniform Code of Military Justice, but they make it clear that they don't put much stock in that and emphasize that people's pledge to the Constitution precedes this. And this does two things. First, it tells people that rather than trusting official channels to deal with any potential problematic orders that they must that might arise, they should just join the Oath Keepers and take matters into their own hands. And second, it makes the Oath Keepers the arbiter of what counts as unconstitutional, not our established regulations and systems. And again, right, this makes sense to them, because what good are regulations and the Uniform Code of Justice, of Military Justice, if the government really is a tyrannical enterprise as they believe? Right? The government isn't going to police itself in that scenario, and so it's up to the people to ensure that these bad things don't come to pass.
Excuse me, just for one moment. I'd like to go ahead and open it up to any questions or comments that any members may have, just so we don't get... Looks like nothing. So, oh yes, Representative Clayman.
Thank you for joining us. One of the questions I have asked myself several times is, what is the actual oath that one takes to join the Oath Keepers? Because I see the list of the 10 thing orders they won't follow, but is there an actual oath that I couldn't find on their website?
Yeah, so they swear their oath to the Constitution, right? But it's this warped notion of that, right? So they have held events where they will welcome, you know, ordinary civilians to take the oath, right, as they're signing up. Again, because they're trying to create this image of we are the protectors and defenders of the Constitution, right? So if they had their own oath, it would kind of go against that. So they swear this oath to the Constitution and then, again, kind of support their ideology with this subsequent, you know, 10 orders we're going to disobey to kind of augment those efforts.
If I may, Representative Clayman, I think that's on page 19, if I'm not correct.
I was going to ask him if it's the one on page 17. The
Sorry, I actually don't have one second.
The slide that has the picture of George Washington, I think that's George Washington kneeling down by his horse.
Yep. 1 second. I'm looking at it right now. So that's right. So you can see right there, right? Recognizing that we swore an oath to support and defend the Constitution, right? So they're citing that oath that all, members of service take when they join up. Because they're trying, I'm going to talk about this in a bit, they're trying to kind of reach some of that legitimacy, towards themselves. And essentially their argument is that, yes, they swore an oath and they swore an oath to the Constitution, but the federal government has since broken that oath. And is now acting in ways against the Constitution, right? And so they're trying to appeal to the people's patriotism, right? To say, you swore an oath to the Constitution, not to this government. And so you need to back that and make sure that you, keep it. So that's kind of the appeal they make to people. So it's not that they have their own oath. They're still swearing the normal oath, but they're almost putting caveats on it in order to further their agenda.
Representative Clayman.
So if I turn, I guess, down to page 18 that has your oath of enlistment, are you saying that they're swearing to the full oath of enlistment, or is it Let me finish the question.
That the military patient. Signs up for. So that's the real thing.
The one the middle class, and you think that's what the Oath Keepers are, that's the Oath Keepers are taking, or you think their oath is only through the, where it ends, all against all enemies, foreign and domestic?
Right. So they are referencing explicitly that military oath.
The entire oath.
Right. The full thing. But again, they put the emphasis on that first part. In their minds, right, they do acknowledge that the back half exists, but they say, notice the order, right? What comes first? You swore an oath to the Constitution. And actually, they like to point to the oath that military officers take, which does not include that back half.
And if I may, Representative Clayman, I think the reason why he had the oath of enlistment is to show that they're not doing the complete oath, that they're leaving those bottom parts out.
And then a follow-up.
Follow-up.
And then turning to page 15, the Declaration of Orders We Will Not Obey, do you view that as part of the oath, or is that different from the oath that they're taking to be members of Oath Keepers?
So it's different than the official oath that they take. It's more of kind of a governing program, right? These are the things that they're concerned about when they are talking about, the ways that the government has gone astray. So this is kind of, one of their primary documents talking about the things that they would oppose if this were ever coming to pass. Right. And again, I think it's a good example of the way they view the government. If you look at this stuff, it's pretty outlandish. And again, references kind of classic militia conspiracies. And that's by design. They believe that the government can and will do this.
Okay, real quick, I have a quick question, and I'll turn it over to Representative Story. On page 17, when we have the dot, dot, dot at the end of that quote, I assume that it goes over to then page 15, the Declaration of Orders We Will Not Obey.
That is correct.
All right, so but when they actually declare their oath, where do they stop? I thought you mentioned that the Declaration of Orders We Will Not Obey was more of a program or agenda than it was the actual oath.
So, yes. So this isn't necessarily like what they're talking about here, right? What you'll notice is that, we recognize that we swore an oath. That's not an actual oath in and of itself. That is their appeal to members of service and law enforcement to get them to join.
I see.
They are appealing to it. That is not something that they raise their hand and say, for example.
Okay. All right, thank you for the clarification. I appreciate that.
Yeah, my apologies for not making that clear. So it does go right from the we affirm and declare the following, and then it goes into the 10 oaths that they, or 10 orders that they would disobey.
Thank you.
But they are explicitly referencing the military oath.
Representative Story.
Thank you. Through the chair, I am confused still. I don't know what the oath is in that back and forth. What if I was to become an oath keeper, what would I have to say and raise my hand to?
So you would swear the military oath? On page 16? Oh, sorry, not 16. On page 18.
On page 18. So that whole thing is what I would swear. Follow up, sir.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yes. But again, the emphasis is on that first part, defend the Constitution.
Thank you.
And if I may, Mr. Reedfeld, Now I'm a little bit more confused. Again, I'm sorry. But I thought that they leave out the last part of that, mentioning the Uniform Code of Military Justice and officers appointed to me and the President of the United mm-hmm. States.
So, again, it's about emphasis, right? When I was talking about, so if you look at the website, or if you look rather at that list of 10 oaths, right, that's their kind of advertising document, right? This is why we want you to join, right? And they conveniently leave that part off because that complicates things as to why people would sign, right? Again, they do reference that part exists on elsewhere, right? So if you go to their About Me section, they do acknowledge that is there. And the way they get around that is by saying you swore an oath to the Constitution first. And really, the military official, like the good example of this is that the oath that military officials sign. Does that make sense, or is it not quite clear yet?
I think with the overall question that the committee has is, what is it that they swear an oath to?
Mm-hmm.
And so I understand it's the Constitution, but we're just thinking, like, what does the oath say, I guess, is really more specifically what we're wondering.
Right. So it is that military oath that
it does
you see.
It does include
mm-hmm. but again,
the United States, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and officers appointed over them through right. regulations.
Right. But to be clear, you don't actually have to take the oath to join with the Oath Keepers, right? It's not like, you sign up. There are plenty of people who never actually formally take this oath and join. All you have to really do is send, a certain amount of money to the Oath Keepers, and they'll send you membership cards and you're part of them, right? Which is why I was explaining at the top that most of the people who do participate in the Oath Keepers are not members of military, law enforcement, or emergency services, right? But again, it's part of this kind of mythologizing of the group, of the organization. So they talk about, you swore an oath, right? You are an oath keeper. And again, their emphasis is on that first part, on the Constitution, right? That you will protect the Constitution and defend it against enemies, foreign and domestic. And essentially, right, by leaving that part off when they talk about this, they're concealing that part when they talk about, what are the types of oaths that we, or rather orders that we would not follow. So they are, explicitly trying to frame their organization in a way that makes essentially exempts people from having to follow federal orders or orders that they might receive from officials, right? So they're trying to undercut that oath that people sign, that people swear.
Any further questions? Please proceed.
Great. So we are now, if I'm correct, on slide 19, which is the same as slide 17. So another thing that the Oath Keepers like to do is they like to cloth themselves in patriotic symbology, frequently linking their cause with the patriots of the 1700s, both in words and in visuals. Right? America loves their founding fathers. For obvious reasons, right? Without them, we wouldn't have a country or a system that had worked so well up until this point. And so by linking their group with those patriots, the Oath Keepers are trying to make their project seem legitimate to ordinary Americans, right? So you can see this tendency right from the various group's founding. The Oath Keepers held their first rally on April 19th, 2009 in Lexington, Massachusetts, right? And that's no accident. April 19th is the anniversary of the first shots fired during the American Revolution in Lexington. Similarly, on the right, you can see the cover photo for the list of orders to disobey, and that's George Washington kneeling by his horse, again, explicitly linking the Oath Keepers with the man who led the Patriots through the Revolution. And if you scroll through their website, you'll see it's filled with similar patriotic imagery. And as I'll show in a bit, these are themes that, come up frequently in Rhodes' speeches, as he likes to invoke the founding fathers and compare our current moment in history with their uprising against the British. Again, hoping that some of that legitimacy will wear off on them. So if we go to the next slide, over the years, the Oath Keepers have demonstrated that they're not just a group that engages in extreme anti-government conspiracy theories, as a number of members have been arrested in connection to criminal incidents since their founding. Much of this illegal activity involves weapon violations, though some did engage in more serious crimes like Darren Huff who in 2010 traveled to Tennessee to make armed citizens arrests of government officials who refused demands to indict President Obama. We go to the next slide. Over the course of their history, though, the Oath Keepers as an organization gained far more attention for their armed operations. The first notable Oath Keeper event happened in 2011, a couple of years after their founding. In August of that year, the Oath Keepers showed up in an Arizona town called Quartzsite, a town that at the time was dealing with an issue of alleged corruption that led to a dispute involving the mayor, the police chief, some of his officers, as well as civilians. A number of Oath Keepers showed up on the grounds of combating what they believed was the imposition of martial law, claiming that the dispute in Quartzsite would be the place where small town America would wake up to the government's corruption and violation of rights. But despite, these kind of lofty goals that they had, the Oath Keepers basically just staged a few marches and then left. And a lot of locals were left feeling, taken advantage of. This was a relatively minor event, and nothing ultimately sinister happened in the town. But it demonstrated the Oath Keepers' willingness to escalate small disputes to the levels of tyranny, and also to insert themselves into tense situations that they seemingly have nothing to do with. Go to the next slide. While their involvement in Quartzsite was relatively minor, a few years later in 2014, the Oath Keepers garnered significantly more attention for a pair of actions that presaged their activity in years to come. The first was their participation in the armed standoff at Bundy Ranch. This was a clash between, cattle rancher Cliven Bundy, as well as supporters, and the Bureau of Land Management over $1 million in grazing fees that Bundy owed for using federal land. Bundy put out a call of support, and in April 2014, the Oath Keepers were among several militias that responded, traveling to Nevada to support the Bundys and prevent the Bureau from seizing cattle. Over the next few days, the two sides squared off against each other, and Bundy supporters famously pointed weapons at the federal agents. But ultimately, the Bureau left in lieu of finding another way to collect that fine. The Oath Keepers and others, declared victory. But even though the Oath Keepers were a notable armed presence during that standoff itself, they actually garnered more attention for what happened next. And that is, many of the protesters ended up sticking around for a few weeks in order to make sure that the Bureau of Land Management didn't just return. But the Oath Keepers ended up fleeing the camp because they believed a rumor that the federal government was preparing to target the area with lethal drone strikes, again, showing just how distorted their view of the government really is. Obviously, that never came to pass, but as a result, the Oath Keepers' reputation was left tarnished among other anti-government groups because they basically cut and ran. This setback, though, didn't stop the Oath Keepers from participating in two other armed standoffs in 2015, first in Josephine County, Oregon, and then in Lincoln, Montana. In both of these instances, the Oath Keepers joined local businesses in disputes with federal agencies and showed up with guns in an effort to intimidate federal officials from taking action. Thankfully, though, both of these incidents ended without violence. But just because no one was hurt doesn't mean that what the Oath Keepers did wasn't incredibly dangerous, right? Their presence helped to turn a legal dispute into an armed standoff, which escalated the danger for everyone involved and could have potentially led to bloodshed. We go to the next slide, I think it is. Yeah. But the Oath Keepers haven't just engaged in operations against the federal government. They are also willing to stand off against fellow citizens, treating them essentially as threats. So in November of 2014, they garnered national attention because an armed contingent showed up during the Ferguson protests to protect local businesses from protesters. These men essentially acted as vigilantes, stationing themselves on rooftops and conducting street patrols. And then they returned again in summer of 2015 during another wave of protests, adding fuel to an already dangerous environment, and doing so despite operating against the wishes of local police. And I think it's important to underscore just how dangerous this was, right? Putting aside the obvious fact that civilians should not be operating as law enforcement, though some Oath Keepers are former law enforcement and military personnel, many are not, which means that they're not trained to operate in these kinds of environments in the best of times, and certainly not during a contentious protest. Furthermore, these men were operating in a community that they did not know and one where the community did not know them, creating a situation where it's not hard to imagine scenarios in which people get hurt, right? One only needs to look at the Rittenhouse shooting in Kenosha in order to see how tragically these actions can end. Over the next few years, the Oath Keepers engaged in similar actions to deter fellow citizens, whether it's providing security during the 2017 Berkeley clashes, offering to protect politicians, or offering people protection to counter the broader left, at Trump rallies and free speech rallies. Many of these actions were designed to oppose the left, which was consistent with the Oath Keeper rhetoric at the time. At various points, they referred to Democrats as a Marxist-Islamist organization, trying to destroy Western civilization. And they basically claimed that Democrats were working with Antifa to impose a socialist takeover. Even in those instances where, they just said they were there to keep people safe, the problem is that they usually came armed with, their guns and their biases. And local observers frequently comment that their presence only serves to ratchet up the intensity in the moment rather than diffusing it, ultimately making violence more likely.
Mr. Chairman.
And that brings us to 2020.
Excuse me one moment.
Which proved to be...
Excuse me one moment. Representative Forrest, question?
Yes, thank you. I just have a couple, just because I want to understand a little bit more the perspective of why they were protesting. And so some of these examples that you gave, so like the courtside example, sounded like more like a local sort of controversy. It wasn't clear to me from your description, like why the Oath Keepers might have thought that there was a need for them to defend the Constitution in that circumstance. And then, for example, the armed standoff at Bundy Ranch, I'm just wondering, in that circumstance, was it, somehow they thought it was unconstitutional that this person would have to pay the fees for grazing, that all ranchers pay those fees for grazing on public lands? I mean, I just want to understand a little bit more about like how they came to think these were actions that needed to be challenged and what the constitutional connection was.
Sure. And that's the important thing that's important to understand with the Oath Keepers is they like to claim things are unconstitutional, right? Or violations of rights and liberties when they're really not. Again, because they have this lens that they view government actions through, that is distorted, right? So for example, in the case of Clive and Bundy, right? They believed that the government was illegally overreaching, right? By saying that Clive and Bundy could not, let his cattle graze, over federal property, that the government had no right to even impose those fees, on a private citizen like Clive and Bundy. And so, they saw the government actions that, during those weeks as examples of that overreach. All the government was trying to do was recoup their losses, right? They were not planning on using armed force to attack Clive and Bundy or anything of that nature, right? But because again, these guys view government actions, through this kind of distorted lens, they viewed it as a threat to Clive and Bundy and his rights. And so that's why they were there to stand off and protect Bundy from, the Bureau of Land Management. But you're right, right? The issue in Quartzsite was this very kind of, again, local dispute that was very convoluted at the time. Essentially, they were there because they believed that the local government was acting, again, in this very tyrannical way. It actually had nothing to do with the federal government, right? This was a local issue. But they believed that some people in the town's rights were being violated. And so they were there to protect those people. Again, I think it's important to differentiate, right, between the rhetoric that the Oath Keepers use of unconstitutional or constitutional, right, constitutionality, essentially, from what is the reality, and understand that these guys are frequently using the language and rhetoric of constitutionality as cover for their beliefs, which are warped by conspiracy.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments?
One other question.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just curious, I have been very politically active individual, have attended many protests, have been a part of protests, but have always been very dedicated to nonviolent civil disobedience as a, minimum, right? That things should be nonviolent. And I'm just wondering, with this particular group, and maybe I'm not unlike others, just because I don't know much about it, is one thing that makes them unique also is that it appears that they're always armed so that they're not ever participating and challenging their government, which I think is every citizen's right, but for my experience, you know, having seeing the pictures, that does change the nature of an event when you have many armed individuals. It just changes the experience. I mean, as someone, that's not a situation that I want to be a part of. Because as you mentioned, you know, those where people's emotions are, you know, intensified in certain circumstances, right? Those are unfortunate situations that sometimes do lead to violence. And so I'm just wondering, like, do they ever participate in these actions without firearms? And would that be something that, you know, makes them unique that they believe they need to be armed, an armed presence?
Mm-hmm. So they do participate in protests without firearms. They don't always carry guns, but they do frequently like to bring guns with them. Again, because, right, and that sends this message, right? Even if they aren't actively pointing at people, right, there is still this, a threat inherent, right? If I have a gun with me, you know, and I'm trying to get you to do something, you're more likely to do it than if I was unarmed. But that said, right, they do protests as you know, they protest, for example, the lockdown protests, and they didn't always carry guns at those. They've been at a bunch of different events. But frequently when they come as an operation, right, they're there, even when they aren't actively carrying weapons, they do like to come kitted up, you know, to clash, right? There is this idea that they might have to get physical at any moment to deter the left to kind of, you know, fight back against the specter of Antifa and things of that nature. So even when they aren't actively carrying firearms, there is this kind of threatening presence about them, you know, given the way that they are dressed and their mindset in that moment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Field Fed. If you please continue.
Will do. So I think, yeah, so we're at 2020. And this was a big year for the Oath Keepers because they dramatically escalated their violent and conspiratorial rhetoric and ultimately their activity. And this really kind of coincided with the change within Rhodes himself, who historically has tended to back down to avoid conflict as well as legal culpability for anything that might happen. But as 2020 went on, he really escalated his rhetoric and became more brazen in his actions, culminating obviously in the January 6th attack. And it began as, you know, kind of everything did in 2020 with COVID. And so these guys were active participants in the lockdown protests, as I just mentioned. And they even started to offer security to people who were trying to oppose lockdown orders and open against government mandates, right? With the idea being that if the government shows up to try and close them, the Oath Keepers will be there to stop them. And of note, actually, if you look at that slide, actually, if you go forward one, if you look at the image on the left, that actually, the New York Oath Keeper being referenced is Robert Menuda, who was eventually charged with seditious conspiracy in connection to that January 6th attack. And then on the right, right, you've got an image that the Oath Keepers put up as basically as the George Floyd protests spread in late May and early June. We saw Oath Keepers take to the streets like they did in Ferguson, again, to protect local businesses from protesters. But as those protests continued, Stuart Rhodes escalated the Oath Keeper rhetoric regarding the movement, labeling it as a violent leftist insurrection enabled by internal and external agents and intent on destroying the country. And in light of this, he called on Oath Keepers across the nation to stand up and defend the country. But things escalate even further if we go to the next slide. In the wake of the murder of a member of the far-right group Patriot Prayer at the hands of a self-proclaimed Antifa supporter. Now Rhodes wasn't just calling on the Oath Keepers to act. He was calling on President Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act and call militias into federal service to crush what he deemed to be a Marxist insurrection carried out by Antifa and Black Lives Matter to overthrow the Constitution. Right? And the idea that the leader of a militia would actively advocate for the federal government to use its power to target perceived enemies is something that would have been, you know, surprising just a few years ago. But in the wake of the 2020 election, if we go to the next slide, it became one of Stuart Rhodes' favorite talking points. In interviews and speeches, Rhodes called on Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act, claiming that the U.S. was in the midst of a coup and a civil war carried out by Chinese agents working with domestic enemies. He repeatedly invoked the Founding Fathers and warned that if Trump did not act soon, then the people would have to do it, and the ensuing struggle would be far bloodier. Rhodes coupled these warnings, as you see on the next slide, by encouraging Oath Keepers to attend the November and December pro-Trump rallies that were held in D.C., to protest the results of the election, Right? And here you can see that indulgence in conspiracy with references to a stolen election and the deep state, as well as an effort to raise the stakes of the moment, encouraging fellow oath keepers to stop by the Arlington National Cemetery to get inspiration because it's their turn to fight for freedom. Rhodes himself followed through on his calls to action and showed up at both rallies in D.C. He didn't really do much during the November rally, but he did give a speech during the December Jericho March where he hit on those familiar talking points of calling for President Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act and warning that if he didn't do so, there was going to be a bloody war. And that brings us to January 6th, which in the interest of time, I'm just going to kind of go through really fast. And I know John is going to speak more at length about the Oath Keeper involvement with that day. But I think it's just impossible to tell the Oath Keeper story without including it, right? So publicly in the lead up to J6, Rhodes and the Oath Keepers encouraged fellow patriots to attend. And in open letters he wrote to the president, he expressed a desire for President Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act. And in one of those letters, he actually warned that Trump should not wait for January 6th to act, because if he did, it would be too late by then. But as the day grew close, Oath Keepers announced that they would be in D.C., on the 6th, and that they would put in a call to action, and they put out a call to action saying that they would be protecting Trump supporters and VIPs. And again, in that way they framed that call to action, they said they were standing up against a coup launched by foreign and domestic enemies, and this was with the last chance to stand against tyranny. But the available evidence indicates that the Oath Keepers did far more than just encourage people to attend that rally. And instead actively began planning shortly after the election to use force to oppose the transfer of presidential power. Again, John's going to get far more, in depth into all of this. I just kind of want to highlight, that the Oath Keepers allegedly arranged for firearms to be stored nearby in Virginia, since they knew guns were illegal in D.C. And they're accused of establishing a quick reaction force, right? A team that could deliver those firearms into Washington in the event that they were deemed necessary. Right. And this is important because it shows that they were willing to kind of back up their words and back up their rhetoric with actual action. So can't see what slide you're on. No, one more back. Yeah. So obviously what this preparation meant was that on January 6th, the Oath Keepers were ready and had trained for the moment. And so it's not surprising, that two stacks of them pierced through the riots and breached the Capitol. Thankfully, that quick reaction force was never activated. But even without it, the Oath Keepers certainly did a significant amount of damage in the Capitol on their own. And I'll quickly wrap up here. In the year since the insurrection, the Oath Keepers have been, dealing with significant legal and public scrutiny. At least 25 Oath Keepers are facing federal charges, 11 of whom, including Stuart Rhodes, are facing charges of seditious conspiracy for their actions, which comes with a 20-year potential prison sentence. In addition to the legal pressure, the company hosting the Oath Keeper message board, which had been a pretty active community, was taken down for a few months, which really kind of disrupted that community and made it difficult for them to bring it back. And then in the fall, as I mentioned, there was a data leak where the Oath Keeper's internal data, including chats, emails, and membership roles, were leaked to the public. Which not only exposed the membership of what had previously been a pretty secretive organization, it also aired their dirty laundry, revealing internal disputes as well as issues. And so kind of as a result of all of these things, in particular that legal scrutiny, they've struggled to recruit new people and raise new money for their operations. And so, as a result, the Oath Keepers as an organization were largely quiet throughout the rest of 2021 and didn't engage in any notable large-scale operations. If we go to the last slide, one more back, yeah. I think it's important to note that even after the insurrection, Stuart Rhodes didn't change his tenor at all. As you can see from this quote from appearance on the Alex Jones show, where he continued to insist that President Biden is a Chinese puppet, and push for further actions like the Founding Fathers. He continued to hit these notes and speeches and appearances for months after the Capitol attack. But more importantly, as someone who's been watching and monitoring this group online, I'm concerned by the continued conspiratorial and occasionally violent, though nonspecific rhetoric that comes out of Oath Keeper spaces, right? Rather than taking the events of January 6th as an opportunity to reflect on their role in the assault in their role in the assault on our democracy, right, and adjust to ensure that it never happened again. Oath keepers either praised the attack or wrote it off as a false flag operation or the work of of leftist provocateurs, right? And so today, these spaces are still filled with conspiracies that frame the Biden administration and the broader left as threats to this country that need to be addressed. And so this remains kind of this powder keg that is vulnerable to future spark. So I will stop there. Thank you very much for your time, and I'd be happy to take any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Is there any questions from committee members? Representative Story.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Through the chair, you said you keep talking about the Oath Keepers as if they were all at the rally. Can you... are you talking about in certain section of the Oath Keepers?
The Oath Keepers as a whole did not show up at the rally. They were there. They were there as a notable contingent, and their leader, Stuart Rhodes, was there. But not everybody who was an Oath Keeper showed up.
Follow up?
And do you have an idea of, since this is happening, has there been a big movement from people who are Oath Keepers to leaving Oath Keepers and coming out and saying, I do not agree with what happened? Can you tell me the status of that?
Yeah, so, you know, it's difficult because a lot, you know, people don't always announce. I have not seen in open chats, you know, Oath Keepers explicitly condemning the actions of that day, right? And I'm talking about the rank and file here in their private in communications with each other, not Oath Keeper messaging. I have not seen condemnations coming about what happened that day. Now, does that mean that nobody left because of what happened on January 6th? No, because it's possible, right, that people just kind of, you know, logged off and went away. And there's no way that, you know, we can know that. But again, the rhetoric in these circles was largely around the ideas of, A, you know, this is a good thing, right? And this, you know, patriots are finally waking up and this is a chance to take our country back. B, that, you know, this, you know, the opposition to it is overblown, right? That, you know, people are making too big of a deal out of this. These were just people exercising their rights. Or probably the most common one, which is that, you know, this is Black Lives Matter, this is Antifa, this isn't actually patriots or Oath Keepers. You know, this was a false flag.
Thank you. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just thinking ahead to the 2022 election, it's really concerning this sort of buildup about election fraud. And I'm just wondering, you know, sort of what you're seeing on that front as it relates to this. And just, you know, if you're seeing anything that works. I mean, there's been so many audits, reviews, like, you know, so many court cases were thrown out. Audits prove, you know, the elections were safe. Here in Alaska, the same thing. But foundational to this, you know, event that happened on January 6th is this idea that it was a fraudulent election. So just if you have any thoughts sort of, you know, looking ahead to 2022 and what you're seeing or thinking about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Election conspiracies still hold tremendous power in these circles. These guys do not believe that the election in 2020 was fair, and they believe that, you know, there's significant doubts about the election, you know, system in this country, right? Even though, again, as you pointed out, time and time again, you know, audits and tests and recounts and everything has been done to, and everything has determined that the 2020 election was secure and that there were no examples of, you know, that there was not large scale fraud or anything that, only a reason to doubt those results. That doesn't matter in these circles, right? They still believe that this was stolen, that this was part of a leftist coup. Because again, they link Biden, President Biden and the Democrats with kind of this broader, like, socialist agenda as part of this effort to overthrow the country and impose a leftist tyranny, on the nation that would ultimately target the right. And so, you know, I haven't seen a lot of chatter about the 2022 elections coming up. You know, we're still, though, what, 9 months away. I would expect that as we get closer, we will start to see, you know, efforts to undermine the legitimacy of those elections, you know, in people's eyes, that line of thought will increase, you know, as we get closer. Because the fact of the matter is we're seeing them, you know, be skeptical about all sorts of different elections up to this point. There's just widespread doubt that the system is secure and that it won't just, you know, fraudulently deliver a victory to Democrats.
Okay, any further questions? Representative Story.
Yes, through the chair. And again, I'm going back to thinking about this organization that certain members, you're explaining, have some certain thoughts about the situation in our country. And, you know, I'm just going back to, has anyone that you heard of talked about what happened that day and how the Oath Keepers, who, again, has decided to express that is not what we're about, or or regrets what happened that day. I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, no. I mean, so I was actually watching the Oath Keepers chats on that day. I mean, it was a fascinating moment around like 2:33, right, as the riot is unfolding. Right up until that point, there had been, support for what was happening, right? And patriots are taking the country back. You know, we're finally doing all these types of things. Around that time, I started to notice some Oath Keepers were posting, that's Black Lives Matter. That's Antifa. That's, those are agent provocateurs, right? And they're, those aren't patriots. Patriots wouldn't do this, right? And I think that's really important and interesting because, I don't know why they said that, but my guess is that there's almost this effort to distance themselves, from that day, right? If they have these set of beliefs, and the people who are acting and participating in that share those beliefs, right? It makes people uncomfortable, right? There's something disturbing about those images of watching people attack the Capitol, the seat of our government, right? And I think it did make people uncomfortable. But rather than, large-scale denunciations and condemning and all that sort of stuff, right? Instead, they try to spin it into more conspiracy, right? Again, that this was somebody else, not us, doing this. And they have since kind of leaned into that messaging. And I have not seen a large scale, doesn't come to mind anyone who has, within the Oath Keepers who spoke out against and said, this isn't us, this isn't what we're about. That's not to say it hasn't happened, right? I haven't read every single message out there. But there hasn't been a widespread effort to say, this isn't us. Instead, again, it's been this double, either, doubling down on what happened that day and saying it was necessary, or saying, that was Antifa, Black Lives Matter, provocateurs, and we had nothing to do with it, trying to kind of absolve themselves in that way from what happened.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I would like to add that we did reach out to the National Organization of Oath Keepers to try to get them before the committee so we can ask some questions and hear more about them. Unfortunately, we have not been able to contact anyone. We did receive a response from the Virginia Oath Keepers, their public affairs officer, Phil Nesbitt, in which he says he's not surprised that you've had trouble contacting members of Oath Keepers. They're undoubtedly keeping a low profile. And then also pointed out that the Virginia Oath Keepers is not and never has been a part of the National Oath Keepers founded by Stuart Rhodes. So there is a disconnect. There is a removal or never been a part of the national efforts. And then I just also want to point out that the Pennsylvania Oath Keepers, they said, we are writing to inform you that we have nothing to do with the National Organization of the Oath Keepers or Stuart Rhodes. Pretty much the same statement. So, and here in Alaska, it doesn't appear like we have an organized state Oath Keepers office. So it was at this time, we don't have anyone else to testify on behalf of Oath Keepers. Thank you very much, Mr. Friedfeld, for sharing your experience and your knowledge. I failed to point out that he is a former New York City police officer, intelligence research specialist with them, and he holds a master's degree in security studies from Georgetown University. So thank you again for sharing your experience and knowledge. We really very much appreciate it.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Okay, and with that, I'm going to just take a quick brief at ease. Okay, going back on the record at 1:207, we're going to ask that Mr. Friedfeld, please stay on the line in case we have, Friedfeld, to please stay on the line in case we have any further questions. Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Alex. And now we have Jonathan Lewis is with a program on extremism at Georgetown University. He has done extensive researches on the evolution of white supremacist and anti-government movements here in the United States. He is an investigator with the National Counterterrorism Innovation Technology and Education Center, NCITE. I don't know if they call that Insight or not, but it makes sense if they did. Before joining the program on extremism, John Lewis also worked as a research assistant at the International Institute for Counterterrorism, which is ICT, and the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point, CTC. He's a co-author of the article that recently came out in December titled The Oath Keepers Nexus to January 6th. He holds a master's in Homeland Security Policy from Rider University. And John Lewis, if you will please state your name and affiliation, which I just acknowledge your affiliation, but if you don't mind, please present your presentation.
Absolutely. Chairman Tuck, members of the committee, thank you very much for the invitation to speak with you all today. My name is John Lewis, research fellow with the Program on Extremism at George Washington University, as well as an investigator with NCITE, the National Counterterrorism Innovation and Technology Education Center. The goal of this presentation, which I'll try and keep fairly short, is to supplement the excellent background that Alex gave, and I'm a big fan, as always, of the work of ADL, and to kind of supplement that and provide a very granular look at the alleged role of the Oath Keepers in the January 6th insurrection. At the Program on Extremism, we track and have tracked since January 7th, 2021, every single federal case that has come out in the District of Columbia for individuals charged for their alleged conduct on that day. And so this will be very narrowly focused, building off of the Department of Justice charging documents, indictments, and other court records from that day in order to paint a picture of what the alleged role of the organization and its members was on January 6th. So if we go to the next slide.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, real quick, Representative Tarr.
Just can we spend 1 second just to look at the information on that slide just to get a sense of it? I don't have it in my packet.
Is this the January 6th data slide?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, I thought we were on the first one. Yeah. So just again, just quick top-level hits of the data that we've compiled to date. So 736 individuals have been charged as of today for their role in the events of January 6th. 87% men, 641 to 13% women, 95 of the data set. States with the highest proportion percentage of cases, Florida with 79%. Followed by Texas, 65%, Pennsylvania, 63%, with New York and California following close behind those. You'll see there the vast majority of cases charged to date, over 77% by the latest statistics, were charged in part using evidence either from individual social media accounts or who were caught on video, on camera, from someone else's social media account. I think this is a very important point that, especially early on in a lot of the investigations in the January 6th, I think a lot of it spoke to a lot of the low-hanging fruit individuals who were very proud of broadcasting their involvement in the events of January 6th, taking photos, videos of themselves in the Capitol building. But I think there is potentially a more troubling kind of piece of that, which is that for many of the individuals who were there, who were proudly broadcasting what they were doing, their actions, that they had broken a door, broken a window, gone into an office, trespassed in some way in the Capitol building. They, in many cases, didn't think that there'd be consequences for their actions because they thought that they were well and truly on the right side of history on that day. They thought that this was their moment to prevent what many of them viewed to be a stolen election, what many of them viewed to be the final instance of this tyrannical government that they were there to oppose. And many of them well and truly thought that this was the culmination of all of their work to that point. 87 individuals out of that 736 have some form of military experience that's been documented. That's about 12% of the total. 79 of those veterans, 2 National Guard, 4 reservists, 1 active duty, and 1 who is attending basic training. And as of today, 21% of the total, so it's 201 cases, have pleaded guilty, with the vast majority of those being for relatively low-level misdemeanor trespass charges, while the more significant cases, which we'll touch on here, are still working their way through pretrial motions or plea negotiations. So if we go to the next slide, we'll see a brief program on extremism typology of this corpus of January 6th defendants. So you'll see on that top vertical there, four buckets effectively that we've broken down in terms of who is alleged to have been at the Capitol. And so this assessment is driven by 4 key variables, which is organization, networks, planning, and violence. So if we start all the way on that right column, we have inspired believers. So individuals who, as far as the Department of Justice has made public, traveled to the Capitol on their own. We're not part of any network. We're not part of any domestic violent extremist group. Simply saw what was going on that day, saw there was a rally, decided to go to the Capitol, and eventually made their way onto restricted Capitol grounds, reached the building in some form, and were charged for it. They planned their own travel, planned their own logistics, and did not engage or conspire with others to commit violent activity on that day. Moving over to organized clusters, these are individuals, friends and family, is the easiest way to think about it. Individuals who shared beliefs, shared ideologies, and in some manner were brought to the Capitol that day in furtherance of those beliefs. They planned logistically to go to the Capitol with a husband, a wife, a cousin, a roommate, a family even, of individuals, including in some cases minor children, who, you know, in some way, shape, or form were brought to the Capitol to see the rally and ended up going over onto Capitol grounds, but again, did not engage in violence as far as they've been charged to date. Moving over once more to spontaneous clusters, this is the newest categorization that we try to input in order to assess individuals who did engage in violence. And so what we saw here, whether it's individuals who traveled alone or traveled in small groups, what we saw happen in many of these really, really deeply interesting cases are individuals who, over the course of these hours during the Capitol riot, ended up in these specific points on the Capitol, like the Lower West Terrace Tunnel, like the East Rotunda, and are alleged to have engaged with other like-minded individuals who, in many cases, they did not know before the events of that day, in some of the most egregious acts of really medieval violence on that day against law enforcement, against members of Capitol Police. And these are, again, we've seen videos and photos of it time and time again by this point. Individuals using bear spray, pepper spray, mace, clubs, bats, shields, stolen riot shields, batons, against law enforcement. And in these cases, it's this spontaneous violence of individuals who seemingly have no connection to the domestic violent extremist groups like the Oath Keepers that we're talking about today, that does pose really, really troubling concerns going forward as we think about, like Alex talked about, future mobilization in 2022 and in 2024. And then the final and smallest category that is the focus of today's briefing is what we're calling militant networks. And those are effectively domestic violent extremist groups, individuals who are adherents of those groups, who are alleged to have traveled to the Capitol at the direction of the hierarchical top-down networks that they are part of. In this instance, we have 55 individuals currently considered to be part of those militant networks, including 24 of the 26 Oath Keepers defendants that we'll be talking about today. The other two, just as a minor note, one is John Schaefer of Ice Earth, who is a lifetime member of the Oath Keepers, who, as far as the Department of Justice has charged, traveled to the Capitol completely of his own volition, separate from any of the conspiracies that we'll be talking about today, and one other individual who at present is not connected in any way to the conspiracy networks we'll be talking about. And so if we go to the next slide, what we'll see here is a basic breakdown of 26 of the individuals aligned, affiliated, or members of the Oath Keepers who are charged for their role in the events of January 6th. So that first column on the left will have the names of all the individuals, whether they are charged with either seditious conspiracy or conspiring to obstruct the official proceeding, whether or not they have pleaded guilty. And then just for the course of this conversation, a brief explainer of what their alleged role is, whether that's individuals who are part of Stack 1, which Alex talked about, part of Stack 2, which is alleged to have breached the Capitol about half an hour later, other members of the Oath Keepers who were present at the Capitol but not in either stack, as well as Stuart Rhodes, the Oath Keepers leader, and Edward Vallejo, who was recently charged alongside Rhodes, who is alleged to have been one of the individuals part of that quick reaction force that was in Boston. And then at the very bottom, you have Michael Simmons, who has not been publicly charged but has been publicly identified as person 10 in these indictments as the operations leader for the Oath Keepers on that day, who in the indictments is alleged to have played a central role in serving as this kind of connective tissue between Stuart Rhodes and members of this conspiracy who would then later allegedly go and breach the Capitol. And then just, again, a brief note on that second bullet point. Four of the conspiracy defendants, so four individuals who were charged as part of this kind of stacked conspiracy of 18, 19 individuals at one point, have pleaded guilty. And those are Caleb Berry, Jason Dolan, Mark Rhodes, and Braden Young. And so as part of that guilty plea, there is some expectation that they may possibly cooperate and in some instances may potentially testify at the upcoming trials this spring and summer against these groups of Oath Keepers conspirators. If we go to the next slide here, we will see just a very basic breakdown here of the 11 recently charged Oath Keepers who have been accused of seditious conspiracy, one of the most serious charges we see in the Capitol data set to date. So we'll see Stuart Rhodes, Edward Vallejo were the two new additions to this data set. The other nine, including Kelly Meggs, Harrelson, Jessica Watkins, Hackett, David Marshall, Joshua James, Roberto Minuta, Brian Ulrich, and Thomas Caldwell, were all previously charged in the previous six superseding indictment against the Oath Keepers. And so they were all repackaged as part of this new conspiracy charge, which, importantly here, directly connects the alleged activities of the Oath Keepers, specifically these 11 Oath Keepers, with a conspiracy to prevent the lawful transfer of presidential power. So earlier, for the first year of the January 6th investigation, most of these Oath Keepers were charged with conspiring to obstruct the congressional proceeding, which was, of course, certifying the election results. But this is the first time that the DOJ has made that direct connection between the alleged activities of the Oath Keepers and a clear attempt to allegedly conspire to prevent the lawful transfer of power. And so if we go to the next slide, what we'll have from here through the end very quickly, first of all, I think it's obviously important to say that everything presented within here stems from primary source documents, which is the bread and butter of the program on extremism. But these are merely allegations, and it's important. It's noted often throughout here, and I've said it far too many times already, but every individual that has been charged is presumed innocent until proven guilty. All the information contained herein is not evidence of guilt, and these are merely allegations. And so I will often refer to these as allegations, and if I don't, you can often just assume that they are. And so what we'll have through the rest of this very quickly is a brief narrative walkthrough of what the government alleges is the formation and execution of this conspiracy. So starting in November, working through December into January 6th, and these really fall into three core buckets. The first is, and Alex already discussed very, very comprehensively on a number of these, public statements by Stuart Rhodes, in which he encourages his followers through his calls to action on the Oath Keepers website, that the election is fraudulent, that the election is stolen, and that they need to mobilize to the Capitol. The second is private communications that the government has made public through these allegations between Stuart Rhodes and other Oath Keepers or within individual chapters of the Oath Keepers, most notably Florida and North Carolina. And then the third, which we'll see, is actions taken by both Rhodes and the Oath Keepers who are later charged, both before January 6th, whether it's the stockpiling and purchase of firearms and firearms equipment, weapons training, paramilitary style training, and eventually what we'll talk about closer to the end, which is the alleged activities of the group itself on January 6th. And so if we start here very simply, this is where the government alleges the conspiracy starts. So as the election, 2 days after the election, the government alleges that Stuart Rhodes began sharing information in this end-to-end encrypted application called Signal in a group chat titled Leadership Intel Sharing Secured. Here on out, the Leadership Intel chat, which included at least one Oathkeepers co-defendant at this point and would later include many more, as the government obviously alleges. And so, again, 2 days after the election, before any results are decided, the government alleges that Rhodes urged his followers to refuse to accept the results of the election and said, quote, "We aren't getting through this without a civil war. Too late for that. Prepare your mind, body, and spirit." And 2 days later, on November 7th, as the election results are beginning to come in, Rhodes then allegedly wrote in the leadership chat that we must now do what the people of Serbia did when Milosevic stole their election, refused to accept it, and march en masse to the Capitol. And so, again, what the government alleges in this case is from early November, from days after the election has taken place, Rhodes is already attempting to rhetorically prep his followers that violence is needed. We have to prevent the theft of this election, and the only way to do so is through force, is through our physical force at the U.S. Capitol. And if you go to the next slide, as we move further into November, you'll see that he claimed to be in contact with this individual named Alexander Savage, and he posted step-by-step instructions to the Oath Keepers website in a call to action, providing these directions to everyone who can view the Oath Keepers website, right? So very public, very, very open claim that he's in direct contact with this author. He calls for complete civil disobedience. They are a foreign government. They are not your government. Swarming the streets and starting confronting their opponents, gathering the Capitol. There were no barricades strong enough to stop them, nor the police determined enough to stop them. After which point, police and military aligned with the people, and then they stormed the parliament, burned down the fake television station, and then they succeeded. And then, so again, in the same time period as he's publicly posting these claims, exhorting his followers publicly to anyone who will listen, that there is a need to do what the people of Serbia did to stop this theft, he is, on November 9th, appointing an operations leader for his January 6th operation, and outlining in a virtual members-only Oath Keepers national call his plan to stop the lawful transfer of presidential power, including making preparations for the use of force. If we go to the next slide here, as we move deeper into November, immediately after this national call that Stuart Rhodes has on November 10th, members of the Florida chapter of the Oath Keepers, including Kelly Meggs, are alleged to have begun using the OKFL Hangout, which includes, again, future Oath Keepers co-defendants Kenneth Harrelson, Joseph Hackett, David Marshall, and others, in which the individual allegedly says, "We have been issued a call to action to D.C., quote, this is the moment we signed up for." Again, so immediately after Stuart Rhodes has this conversation with the national Oath Keepers, anyone who is invited, Ohio State regular militia member, which is an Oath Keepers affiliate. And it's just important to make that very clear that she's a member of the Oath Keeper or a member of the Ohio State regular militia, which itself is a affiliate of the Oath Keepers. She sends messages allegedly to several people who she had listed as recruits in her phone, telling them that there was a military style basic training class her militia was organizing for the beginning of January 2021 to get everyone fighting fit by inauguration. So again, more evidence, as the government alleges, of this kind of relationship between the public statements by Rhodes, the private statements by Rhodes, and then the direct connection to actions taken covertly by his followers, members of the Oath Keepers and their affiliates, to prepare for this action. So if we go to the next slide here.
Real quick, we have a question from Representative Story.
Thank you, through the chair. Are you saying that if I was a member of Oath Keepers, I would have gotten a message about this through my local chapter or just however my member, however I'm notified? that this would be taking place, or was this just going to a small group with inside Oath Keepers?
Yeah, so my understanding, based on what the government has alleged, is that it was invitation only, but that it would have been sent out to chapters within the Oath Keepers, who would then disseminate it as they see fit. So as Alex talked about earlier, I don't think every single person who had sent money to the Oath Keepers would automatically have received such a invitation, but that a significant enough group, including individuals who Stuart Rhodes believed to be trustworthy, including obviously many of the regional team leaders, right, of North Carolina, of Florida, of Arizona, the government alleges. But I don't think it would have been every single person who's ever donated money is going to suddenly get a Teams or a Zoom link in their email.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point, because I'm just curious, you know, one of the reasons we're having this conversation is to understand sort of like what general membership means, who the organizers are, that kind of thing. And so given these indictments have been issued, you know, certainly this communication has been monitored. Whether you can answer this or not, let me know. But, you know, is it expected that additional indictments are coming? Like, is it, a ripple effect of, you know, now that we've monitored the communication and, you know, been able to look at, you know, this group, you know, it's expected then there's like going to be a ripple to another layer that gets to that? Because I guess what would be helpful to know is, you know, for example, in Alaska, if we had anyone that was part of that communication network with the actual planning in this very specific way.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's a couple important points that go into that answer. The first is that, as best has been made public, the Department of Justice has very intentionally narrowed the scope of their investigation and prosecution. So, for example, I think if you look at open source reporting, I've seen estimates of anywhere from 10 to 20,000 individuals who were present on what would be considered technically restricted Capitol grounds, right, on that day. So within that barrier perimeter on the grounds of the Capitol, which in itself, by technicality, is sufficient for a misdemeanor trespass charge. But what we've seen from DOJ is that they are narrowing it into three distinct buckets. The first are individuals who are alleged to have actually entered the Capitol, breached the Capitol. There was one case very early on, maybe in the first 2 months of the investigation, where they had charged an individual from New York, only to later drop the charges after realizing that he hadn't actually entered the Capitol. He had just talked about, I think he was near some steps, but he had not actually entered the building. And so they're narrowing it out where if you're just an individual who traveled there, who's standing, near the reflecting pool or, you know, on the West Lawn, for example, it seems unlikely to date that you would be charged. And then the second and third categories would be individuals who allegedly engage in violence and individuals who play a sufficiently significant enough role in the conspiracies to date. And that's, I think, the specific point to get at here. There have been a number of individuals as direct parts of this conspiracy network, as the government has alleged, including person 10, who is Michael Simmons, the Oath Keepers operation leader, as well as the leader of the Oath Keepers North Carolina chapter, both who are alleged to have been the North Carolina leader was alleged to have been, I believe, in the Boston Hotel, which we'll talk about in a little bit, where the QRF was. And person 10, Michael Simmons, who was alleged to have been at the side of Stuart Rhodes for most, if not all, of this day. It's not entirely clear why neither of those individuals have been charged, given they have both been identified in these indictments as having been playing a role in this. So it is certainly possible that as they continue, they seized Stuart Rhodes' phone, I believe, maybe May of 2021. They seized the general counsel, Kelly Sorrell's phone, I believe around that same time. Now that Rhodes has been arrested and denied bail, I'm confident there is potentially more evidence that will come out regarding his communications with other Oath Keepers. So I would certainly not rule out potential future you know, charges against individuals who were directly connected to the communication networks that were going on at that time. Although it is, again, it's hard to say for the Department of Justice where that exact line might be in terms of, again, as we all talk about, communication versus overt action, right?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lewis. You can proceed.
Yeah. So if we're on the Thomas Caldwell slide on November 9, 2020, this was Thomas Caldwell, and again, another Oath Keepers affiliate. He allegedly reached out right after the election to Stuart Rhodes to provide the results of what he called a lengthy reconnaissance trip he had taken to Washington, D.C., and begun coordinate planning with Rhodes for their upcoming operation in Washington, D.C. And then several weeks after that, again, as we talked about with that Florida chapter, which had allegedly been beginning to mobilize because they had received that call to action, multiple members, including the three co-defendants you see there, allegedly held a training on unconventional warfare. And if we go to the next slide, we move here into December of 2020. On December 11th, which I believe is the day before the Jericho March that Alex mentioned earlier that took place in D.C., Stuart Rhodes allegedly communicates in a separate signal group chat titled December 12th, D.C. Security/Leadership, which, again, includes Oath Keepers defendants that were later charged, including Joshua James and New York Oath Keeper Roberto Menuda. And in that conversation, he allegedly says that if President-elect Biden were to actually assume the presidency, quote, it would be a bloody and desperate fight. We are going to have a fight, and it cannot be avoided. And then the very next day, the North Carolina chapter that we just talked about in relation to their leader allegedly held a training session that you can see there, which included vehicle operations, roadblocks, vehicle recovery, convoy operations, setting up hasty ambushes, reacting to ambushes, and falling into formation. So again, just that connection there between the public rhetoric by Rhodes and the private training and mobilization that is alleged to have taken place by his followers in a kind of, again, this call and response, which becomes a very common pattern here. If we go to the next slide, again, as Alex laid out very well, December 12th is this Jericho March. There's some quotes here from the ADL site on the right here, where he calls on President Trump once again to invoke this Insurrection Act. And I think this is an important point that Alex touched on that I just want to hit harder here, which is that in the eyes of Stuart Rhodes by this point, the government was not the enemy, right? Like, as Alex kind of laid out, the government had always kind of been that boogeyman in the back of the Oath Keepers' minds. And you know, so many of their offline mobilizations time and time again were kind of designed to set the Oath Keepers up as that balance, as that counter to this tyrannical government. And instead, now what you see here is this anti-government, anti-authority group calling on a sitting president to invoke an insurrection act merely to allow this anti-government group to be called up as some kind of quasi-militia, right? And this is all just, again, I hit on it in the testimony a bit, but it really does speak to this kind of worldview shift that Rhodes specifically, and again, Rhodes is almost indistinguishable from the kind of national brand that is the Oath Keepers, right? Where Rhodes goes, the Oath Keepers have typically followed. And that worldview shift where all of a sudden this kind of leftist, Antifa, Black Lives Matter, anti-Trump ideology had taken up that mantle in the eyes of Rhodes, in the eyes of the Oath Keepers, as that kind of pervasive threat that was sorely in need of a response. And Rhodes viewed the Oath Keepers in many instances as that response. And so again, what you see here, he called on Trump to invoke the Insurrection Act to help him remain in power, adding that if he does not do so, groups such as the Oath Keepers, again, would have to mount, quote, a much more desperate and much more bloody war, quote, to ensure that outcome. And then you'll see 2 days later, Rhodes allegedly continues to make public and private claims that the use of force in this instance is required to stop the transfer of presidential power, right? He publishes a letter on the Oath Keepers website, which again, anyone, member, non-member, can read, advocating for the use of force. 2 days later, he sends a similar message to the Oath Keepers of Georgia. And again, you'll see one future co-defendant respond, "I'm not a soldier, but I am focused, and I stayed at a Holiday Inn once, so it's game on time." And again, just more of this trend which we keep hitting on, which is call and response, call and response. If we move to the next slide, we'll see on December 21st, you'll see Joshua James allegedly posted a message into that leadership intel chat saying that the Southeast region, quote, is creating a national call to action for December, DC, January 6th. Four states are mobilizing. And again, no one responds, and he sends, "Did no one hear me? Three states are mobilizing to DC." I'm not sure which one got lost in that second message, but regardless, you'll see on December 22nd, Rhodes gave an interview to a regional Oath Keepers leader that I believe was made public in some capacity. And again, just this trend again and again and again, he says, quote, "We will have to do a bloody, massively bloody revolution against them. That's what's going to happen." And he cites January 6th as, quote, "a hard constitutional deadline to use that military force as required." So if we go to the next slide, we'll see on December 25th, more of the same, invite-only chats. He allegedly posts in the OKFL, the Florida Hangout chat, saying that, we have to stop the transfer of power. And then one future co-defendant, Kelly Meggs, allegedly says, quote, "We need to make those senators very uncomfortable with all of us being a few hundred feet away." And Rhodes allegedly responded, quote, "I think Congress will screw him," referring to President Trump, "over. The only chance we/he has is if we scare the shit out of them and convince them that it will be torches and pitchforks time is if they don't do anything, if they don't do the right thing, but I don't think they will listen." So if we go to the next slide here, we're into the very end of December here. So December 29th and 30th, Stuart Rhodes, this begins a trend that we'll see a couple more times, both before and after January 6th, where Stuart Rhodes is alleged to have purchased tens of thousands of dollars of firearms and firearms components and other kind of just various firearms tools, right? So on December 30th, he allegedly purchases two night vision devices and one weapon sight and has them shipped to an individual in Virginia near Washington, D.C., where they arrived 2 days before January 6th. And then on that same day, Rhodes allegedly creates a new chat called DC Op Jan 6/21, where he invites, as you can see, numerous future co-defendants, including Kelly Meggs, Kenneth Harrelson, Jessica Watkins, Joshua James, Roberto Menuda, Kenneth Hackett, Brian Ulrich, and Edward Vallejo to join that leadership signal chat. And again, you can see through the rest of it that Rhodes and his co-conspirators and allegedly used this chat to continue to plan for their operation on January 6th, even posting on December 31st, quote, "There is no standard political or legal way out of this." We go to the next slide. So we get into January, right? So on the first 2 days of January, 1st and 2nd, Rhodes allegedly spends $5,000 on firearms and related equipment, including a shotgun, scope, magazine, sights, optics, a bipod, a mount, case of ammunition, and gun cleaning supplies. That day, he allegedly messages Kelly Meggs and offers that they can stow their weapons with the operations leader, who has been identified by public reporting as Michael Simmons. He'll have a secure car trunk or his hotel room or mine. They discuss the QRF, which I'll get into in a couple minutes. And then on that same day, Oath Keepers defendant Thomas Caldwell communicates with the North Carolina QRF team leader, where they go back and forth on how many individuals will be staying back versus going into D.C. Go to the next slide. On January 2nd, you'll see Kelly Meggs and Thomas Caldwell are allegedly engaging in pretty detailed plans for what to do with this quick reaction force. And so we'll touch on it a bit in the next slide. But as Alex mentioned, one of the really concerning tidbits that has come out as the investigation continues is just how well-armed the Oath Keepers allegedly were. So the 11 who were charged in the conspiracy indictment are all alleged to be individuals who transported firearms or provided firearms to this quick reaction force. And so what you'll see here is allegations that they expect civil disorder to take place on January 6th. They expect bridges to be closed. They expect roads to be closed. And so you see there the North Carolina team leader of the QRF is allegedly saying that one of his sources in D.C. is trying to procure boat transportation. Kelly Meggs is posting a map of D.C. with the Lincoln Memorial, saying that if you can get here by land in your vehicles, referring to the QRF, we'll meet at the Lincoln Memorial. And if you can't, the corner of West Basin and Ohio is a water transport landing. And so what you see here is allegations of detailed operational planning by the Oath Keepers, who were well aware of D.C.'s strict firearms regulations, which in many instances appears to have deterred individuals from bringing firearms into the district, and instead stockpiling them, as the next slide will show, in this QRF hotel. And so what the allegations are is that Oath Keepers defendants, over the course of these 4 days, as they arrived in D.C., began transporting firearms. You can see in this photo the long guns that are alleged to have been transported in to this quick reaction force staging area in Ballston, at a Comfort Inn in Ballston, which is Arlington, Virginia, about a 10-minute drive, stone's throw away from D.C. So you can see in that bottom right bit the allegations that this group of folks transported firearms, ammunition, and related items, which again allegedly include those night vision goggles. As you can see in that bottom left bit, on those days, as he's traveling towards D.C., Rhodes spends an additional $10,500 on firearms equipment, including an AR platform rifle, sights, mounts, triggers, and slings. And the allegation by the government is all of these items that Rhodes purchased were then transported to this QRF for potential use by Oath Keepers in D.C. in the event of this expected civil disorder. If we go to the next slide, as we get into the January 6th kind of operation, the allegation is that early that morning, Rhodes messaged the signal chat, quote, "We will have several well-equipped QRFs outside D.C., and there are many, many others from other groups who will be watching and waiting on the outside in case of worst-case scenarios." And again, what this, as best as the government has laid out, generally refers to is this sense that in many ways this threat of Antifa, threat of the left, was playing a significant part of Rhodes' mind. And so what you'll see, Rhodes and Michael Simmons travel into D.C. early that morning. And then Edward Vallejo, as it says there, goes on a podcast early that morning, discusses the possibility of armed conflict and guerrilla war, and says that, quote, "There are people who are prepared, have the will, have the facilities to do more than taunt." So if we go into the next slide. So at 1:15 is the approximate first breach of Capitol grounds we talked about, which is just this kind of outer barrier of effectively bike racks that were set up by Capitol Police. So just before 1:30 p.m., an Oath Keepers affiliate posts in the leadership chat that Antifa had allegedly breached the Capitol, at which point Rhodes, who is in the area, responds, quote, "Nope, I'm right here. These are patriots." He then continues to say, quote, "Pence is doing nothing as I predicted. All I see Trump doing is complaining. I see no intent by him to do anything. So the patriots are taking it into their own hands. They have had enough." And then a couple minutes later, he says, you know, "The founding generation stormed the governor's mansion in Massachusetts, tarred and feathered his tax collectors. They seized and dumped tea in the water. They didn't fire on them, but they street fought. That's where we are now. Next comes our Lexington. It's coming." So if we go to the next slide. At around 2 p.m., the government alleges that Stack 1, which Alex talked about, which I'll have a photo of in a couple slides, began moving towards the Capitol, at which point Jessica Watkins allegedly made an announcement on this internal Oath Keepers Zello, which is push-to-talk, walkie-talkie over cellular phone application, made on this Stop the Steal J6 channel, saying that, quote, "It has spread like wildfire that Pence has betrayed us, and everybody's marching on the Capitol. We have about 30 to 40 of us. We're sticking together and sticking to the plan." And then reports at about 2 o'clock that they are allegedly one block away from the Capitol. If we go to the next slide, at about 2:12 to 2:14 p.m., the government alleges that Stuart Rhodes entered restricted Capitol grounds on the northeast side of the Capitol. And about 2 minutes later, the operation leader, who is believed to have been with Rhodes at this point in time, messages the signal chat saying, quote, "They have taken ground at the Capitol. We need to regroup any members who are not on mission." And so again, in this continuation of what we talked about earlier, we see allegations that this was not some spontaneous action by random members of the Oath Keepers. This was not some coincidence that Stuart Rhodes just happened to be there. The allegations that the government has set forth are that Rhodes was playing a direct operational role along with his operations leader, directing, guiding, marshaling his forces to specific points at the Capitol in an attempt to breach the building. And so if we go to the next slide, this speaks much more to that. So you'll see at about 2:21 to 2:25, the government alleges that the majority of these defendants, including members of Stack 1, Kelly Meggs, Jessica Watkins, Joseph Hackett, David Marshall, enter restricted Capitol grounds. And then Stuart Rhodes allegedly messaged Kelly Meggs saying, quote, "Go to south side of the Capitol. That's where I am going to link up with the operations leader," who, as we discussed, is allegedly Michael Simmons. And 2:25, Rhodes forwards a message from the operations leader to the leadership chat saying, "We need to regroup any members who are not on mission. Come to the south side of the Capitol on steps," and then sends a picture of his location, at which point the Oath Keepers in Stack 1 allegedly, again, the call and answer, begin moving towards that location to allegedly meet up with Stuart Rhodes. If we go to the next slide, we'll see here the final phone calls that the government alleges took place immediately before the alleged breach. And so what you see here, 2:32 p.m., Kelly Meggs calls Stuart Rhodes, who is on the phone with the operations leader. Stuart Rhodes then allegedly conferences in Kelly Meggs to the call. And then 3 minutes later, you know, at the direct conclusion of that phone call, the government alleges that Kelly Meggs, who had just gotten off the phone with Stuart Rhodes, and the balance of what eventually would be forming Stack 1, maneuvered in an organized fashion up the steps to the east side rotunda doors in that stack formation that Alex talked about, and that one of the Oath Keepers who had previously arrived at that location joined up with Stack 1, Kenneth Harrelson, and that Stack 1 then pushed forward as part of this broader mob that advanced toward the rotunda doors, assaulted law enforcement officers, threw objects, sprayed chemicals, and pulled violently on the doors. If we go to the next slide, we'll see, again, the photo Alex discussed, Stack 1 moving up in this stack formation up the Capitol steps. If we go to the next slide here, this is a very useful descriptive picture the government has published. If you can see the timestamp in the top left corner of that photo, 2:41 p.m. So this is about 6 or 7 minutes after Stack 1 makes their way up the steps, about 8 to 9 minutes after Kelly Meggs allegedly gets off the phone with Stuart Rhodes. And the government then, as you can see from the multicolored boxes and arrows, identifies, again, numerous co-defendants that are listed there. If we move ahead one, I'll move quickly for the sake of time. Here you can see Oath Keepers allegedly in the rotunda. Watkins allegedly says, "We're in the mezzanine, we're in the main dome." And then some members of Stack 1 exit the rotunda towards the Senate chamber. And then one says, "The fight's not over," waves other rioters down the hallways towards the chamber. If we go to the next slide, this is a really interesting bit that came out recently regarding the movement of the Oath Keepers. New in this new indictment, if you look at the bottom, which is the 106 bit, they allege that Stack 1 members actually walked out of the rotunda and towards the House of Representatives in search of Speaker Pelosi. Again, not just allegedly some trespassing or some going into random offices, but that they left the rotunda to search for the Speaker of the House, which, again, given the implicit explicit threats of violence, is obviously a concerning trend. If we go to the next slide here. So as Stack 1 is in the rotunda, Stack 2, which you can see on these golf carts, some individuals here had allegedly been members of the security detail for Roger Stone, or other Speaker VIPs from that day. They receive word that individuals have breached the Capitol. They get on these golf carts and allegedly move on the golf carts towards the Capitol. And you can see from the quote down there, Patriots storming the Capitol building, violence against Patriots by the D.C. police. So we're en route in a Grand Theft Auto golf cart to the Capitol building right now. It's going down. If we move to the next slide, you'll see here very briefly, I believe, Roberto Menuda with Stack 2 allegedly at the U.S. Capitol, aggressively berating, taunting law enforcement who were guarding the perimeter of the Capitol building. And then at around, if you go to the next slide, at around 3:15, Stack 1 begins to allegedly be pushed out of the Capitol near the rotunda doors. And then Stack 2 actually advances into those same rotunda doors that Stack 1 in that picture we just saw had moved through about 35 minutes earlier. In an attempt to, again, further breach the Capitol building. We go to the next slide. So this is now 3:30 p.m., so about an hour since the initial breach by members of the Oath Keepers, allegedly. Rhodes is reported to put a message in the Signal chat saying, anyone in D.C. who is not tasked with security detail, come to the U.S. Capitol on the Supreme Court side. Come to the northeast corner. The government alleges that both stacks are forced out by riot police, and they regroup on that northeast corner with Stuart Rhodes. If you go to the next slide, this is the kind of allegations of this kind of debrief. They reportedly go to a local Olive Garden and celebrate their attack on the Capitol and discuss next steps. And then, as you can see from those messages on that right side, A, B, C, and D, co-conspirators allegedly post things to, you know, along the lines of, you know, thousands of ticked off patriots spontaneously marching the Capitol. You ain't seen nothing yet. We'll be back to 6 a.m. Do it again. We ain't quitting. We're reloading. There's nothing compared to what's coming. And if we go to the next slide, the government alleges that in the weeks following January 6th, Rhodes spent an additional $17,500 on firearms parts, ammunition, scopes, targets, mounts, and other items. And one defendant, Joshua James, allegedly then met Rhodes in Alabama after January 6th, collected all the available firearms, and returned with Rhodes to Texas, where they stayed for quite some time. On the next slide, the government closes their indictment by alleging that on Inauguration Day, one individual with the Oath Keepers messaged another saying, after this, if nothing happens, it's war, Civil War 2.0, and that around the time of the inauguration, Rhodes allegedly messaged others to organize local militias to oppose President Biden's administration. And so if we go to the next and last slide here, just I think that was obviously a lot of continued court regurgitation there, but just some kind of considerations based on this research at this point. What the Oath Keepers will look like post Stuart Rhodes. He's the only leader they ever had. He is the only, he is the founder. The group is Stuart Rhodes. The general counsel, Kelly Sorrell, took over very briefly as acting president, but announced after Rhodes was detained pretrial that she couldn't do it in the long term. There's always going to be a question of the use of seditious conspiracy charges against Rhodes and the potential for this potentially further emboldening these claims that January 6th was a false flag or that it's politically motivated persecution or that the DOJ is targeting individuals for their ideology. Regardless of what happens, I think with the Oath Keepers, it's important to not risk missing the forest for the trees here and recognize that this patriot militia movement that Alex spoke about is far more at this point than the Oath Keepers. They have had so much time, such a permissive environment for which to organize, especially at the local level, that the death of one organization, even one of the biggest in this space, like the Oath Keepers, is not the death of a movement. It's not the death of an ideology. And that these narratives, these drivers, these mobilizing concepts, like white supremacy, like anti-Semitism, anti-democratic efforts, they continue to rise. And simply, targeting Stuart Rhodes and the Oath Keepers for their role is obviously very important, but not a be all end all. And I'll leave it there. It went a bit over, but I'm happy to answer any and all questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lewis. I appreciate it. Any questions from committee members? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. two things. One is, just sort of a comment, and I was trying to remember, in terms of who's been indicted, you mentioned that the operations person hadn't been indicted, and I don't know if you can comment, but I guess would the suggestion by that be that perhaps that person has become a government witness? Because it's hard to see how all this communication, that there'd be some people left out of the indictments. And then just the timeline for kind of moving this forward. You know, you showed on the first slide the percentage of individuals who pleaded guilty. Mm-hmm. You know, sort of how do we expect things to transpire so we know more?
Yeah. So on the operations leader point, I think it's an even coin flip at this point. And again, I have no inside information with which to guess, but this is an educated guess based on all this. I think it's about evens that he is either cooperating because of the threat of charges against him, or they were waiting for more solid, concrete information from some digital devices, some communications, or the arrest of Rhodes potentially to bring charges against him. And I think it's always important not to speculate too much because, again, Rhodes wasn't charged for over a year, right? He was identified as person one in 6 consecutive conspiracy indictments. Very clear, like openly, very clearly, this was Stuart Rhodes in these indictments. But he was not charged for, you know, a year and a week since January 6th. So it's this open question of which way that falls. In terms of the outcomes, it's difficult because new cases are coming still nearly every day. They've worked out, as we talked about 200 so far, mostly low level cases. I think we may see more plea agreements as individuals start running out of legal arguments against pretrial or pretrial motions. So some of the charges that have been brought were fought in court in terms of the applicability. Most judges have ruled that they are applicable, and so you may soon see more individuals pleading out in an effort to reduce their sentencing. But in many cases, it's this massive backlog of cases at this point. D.C. has had a backlog even pre-Jan 6 because of COVID. They're prioritizing cases in which individuals, not just Jan 6 folks, are incarcerated, which is only a very small minority of probably less than 50 at this point who are detained pre-trial out of that 736. And so for a lot of them, especially the low-level misdemeanor cases, their options at this point are effectively plead out or effectively just sit at home and wait for them to work through all the felony cases. So it may be going for quite some time at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I have a quick question. Do we know if members of Oath Keepers who are active military or law enforcement ever asked to not follow their supervisors or their commander's orders?
In terms of individuals who are in the military who are part of the Oath Keepers?
Yes.
Yeah. It is certainly possible. I don't have any direct insight on that. There's nothing that has been alleged or reported in terms of the DOJ side. I think the challenge with something like that is the fact that, by and large, the Department of Defense is not exactly transparent in identifying individuals who may or may not have some ideological affiliation to the Oath Keepers or to any other hate group, anti-government group, white supremacist group. So even if in some instance there was some disciplinary issue regarding a member of the Oath Keepers for that reason, I suspect it would not be publicized, which is difficult.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other further questions for our two presenters? Well, thank you very much, Mr. Lewis, for sharing where we're at with how these events led up to January 6th and then what's going on currently in the investigation and in the allegations. So we very much appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Okay, that concludes our committee hearing business today. Our next special committee on military and veterans affairs will be 1 p.m. on Tuesday, February 15th, right here in the Grunberg Room. We'll be holding another informational hearing on Oath Keepers and the role in January 6th attack in the U.S. Capitol. At that time, we have a presentation by Sam Jackson, author of Oath Keepers, Patriotism, and the Edge of Violence in a Right-Wing Anti-Government Group. We also have Matthew Kreiner, colleague of John Lewis, that is a senior research scholar at the Center of Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism at the Mildewary Institute of International Studies at Monterey. I also want to remind everybody that we are actively trying to find someone with Oath Keepers to represent in front of the committee as well to tell their story. At this time, we haven't been able to find anyone. And but we're going to, if anybody has any further suggestions, please let us know. And with that, if there's no further business, the House Military Veterans Affairs Committee will be adjourned at 3:02 p.m.